Jimbo Paris, and you are listening to the Jimbo Paris Show. All right. Hello, everyone. I am Jimbo Paris. Welcome again to the Jimbo Paris Show. And today we have a very special guest today. We have Agent Crew, CEO of Wine Spies and owner of Jurassic Wines. And very successful man and a very interesting fellow. He has some nice sunglasses that I would like to show too. So let's bring him up.
Hey, Jimbo, thanks for having me on. Spies got to rock the look, you know?
Yeah, you look good, man. You look good.
Thanks. I don't want to keep the mystery for too long, though. So,
So Agent Crew, can you kind of give me a gist of sort of what your background is?
Yeah, absolutely. So my family has a winery in Sonoma Valley. It's called Deerfield Ranch Winery. And my father's actually an architect. It's my uncle that's the winemaker. 16-year-old kid, when they're asked what they want to do, and alcohol is one of the options, that was an easy choice. So I kind of started my career as a cellar rat at Deerfield and worked for them for the first part of my career. I eventually became the general manager of the winery there and moved over and joined my business partner here at Wine Spies 5 years ago. And it's been a crazy ride.
Where are you from?
Originally, I'm from Marin County, which is just south of Sonoma. So for those of you that aren't familiar with Northern California wine country, everyone knows Napa. So Sonoma is the county directly to the west of it. And there's a lot of grapes out here too. Yeah.
Okay. And again, this is for ignorant people out there, but how is wine generally made and what is it?
Well, you can technically make wine from any fruit, but typically when people say wine, they're thinking of wine made from grapes. It's not just any grape. There's a specific species called Vitis vinifera, which is wine grape vine, basically. And all of the things you've heard of, like Cabernet, Pinot, Merlot, all of those are basically just different subvariants of that one type of vine. And you just take the grapes, ferment them, all of the yeast turns the sugar into alcohol, and boom, you've got wine. Humans figured that out a long time ago.
Wow. Okay. So let's focus on your business. What is the story of Wine Spies? And what was sort of your journey into the family business?
So Wine Spies is pretty cool. It's actually today the longest running wine sale flash site in the world. So my business partner, Agent Red, he founded it in 2007. The only one at the time was Wine Woot, which was kind of a spinoff of the Woot, which kicked off the whole idea of a flash sale company. And then was since purchased by Amazon, who then shut it down when they bought Whole Foods and started Amazon Wine. So Wine Spies going strong since then. We sell one different wine every 24 hours. So the clock strikes midnight, a brand new wine comes up on the site. So, you know, it was an interesting kind of path how I ended up coming over to Wine Spies. I really never thought that I would leave the family business. And, you know, it was certainly my life for the 8 years, the whole beginning part of my career. There's, you know, plenty of challenges in running a family business and different sorts of ideas sometimes about how things should be done. But it really was, a wonderful opportunity for me to experience a great number of different wines. That's what's so fun about Wine Spies is all these different wines that we try every day. The way that it works is on Fridays, we taste through all of the wines that are sent to us to review and decide upon. And then only one wine per day is what we need to make the cut. So today we've got probably 40 different wines to taste. In fact, right after this, we'll go do the wine tasting. So most of the wines don't make the cut. And that way you get to learn about many different wines. Every day is a new story. So it's really been an awesome way to expand my palate and just experience the wines of the world. So it's a hard opportunity to pass up.
So do you have any businesses right now aside from Wine Spies?
Yes, we recently acquired a nutritional supplement company called Goldmine, and it's a mushroom supplements, adaptogens, really interesting kind of budding area. The actual mushrooms themselves have been used in medicine for, again, millennia. I guess there's a theme there. Just regular stuff like reishi, ashwagandha, chaga, turkey tail, maitake. And the health benefits have been well known, but recently there's just been a huge public awareness of that. So products like Goldmine, Yeah, definitely really hot right now. There's a little sachet packet. So it's in tons of Whole Foods right now and it's just taken off. It's been awesome to see and kind of an interesting new field for me. I've been heavily involved in the production side on wine, so I'm familiar with some of the challenges of packaging and things like that. But working with a co-packer has been a totally new experience and a lot to learn there. And as much experience as I have on the distribution side with trying to get a wine onto a grocery store shelf, it's a little bit different when you're in the nutritional supplement space. So it's been an interesting journey, but Wine Spies is definitely the big thing that, you know, is the most important one that we spend our attention on. And it's been great. It's been growing like crazy. If you are interested in, you know, in wine, it's a beautiful place to discover wines because every single wine that we sell is a wine that we love. We do all the vetting, but we also sell brands that people already know and like at the best price in the world. So a lot of people find us in the first place because they're looking for a particular wine and they happen to see we have it that day for a crazy price. But then they stick around because they quickly realize every bottle they're opening is delicious. And that paired with our locker system where you can buy one or two bottles of wine and then put it in your case. And once you get a full case, a locker full, you can ship it for free. We're the innovators that started doing that. A couple of people have tried to copy it poorly, but we have an excellent implementation that just makes it super easy for people to do that. And since you need to sign for alcohol, it's very convenient because they only have to be there to receive one package instead of 10 different wine shipments.
And what is the favorite wine that you have made?
So we actually have our own house brand, Enigma. We do great Cabernets specifically right now. Those wines, the whole thing behind them is that we're actually buying bulk wine from a winemaker that we can't even reveal who it is. There's a lot of wine in the industry. Well, let's say, okay, so if you have a really sought after wine brand or a winemaker, if they make too much of a wine that year for whatever reason, and they don't think that they can sell it all, they have to figure out something to do with it, but they don't want their name on other people's projects. And so there's actually contracts that require you to non-disclose who this winemaker is, even though people would love to know that. So that's where Enigma was born. Me personally making wine, I made a Petit Verdot years ago, and I love Petit Verdot. It's people, you know, a little bit less well-known, but you've probably had quite a bit of it if you've ever had a Cabernet, because it's used traditionally as a blending grape to give some more structure and usually a little bit more strength to the wine. So it's not very often that you see it by itself as the star of the show, so to speak. So I think it has its own flavor that's just lovely. And it's actually got a little bit of a cult following. And you don't see it very often because not much of Petit Verdot is grown. You only need maybe 2 or 5% in a Cabernet to kind of do its thing. So consequently, there's not too many of them out there. That was probably my favorite that I've personally ever done.
And speaking of wines, you know, I've always liked wines and whiskeys and those types of things. But, you know, I think when you think of America, there's always this talk about beer, beer, beer. Do you think the wine will ever be taking over that industry as well?
Well, in the BevAlc industry, as we call it, there's another term called share of throat. And it's always a constant concern for how much people are choosing wine, spirits, or beer. And nowadays, there's entirely new categories like hard seltzers, White Claw. And then now the new fear of the wine industry is RTDs, ready-to-drink beverages. So those are pre-mixed cocktails, for example. I think what happens is as people get older, wine is a special thing. There's not really, you know, cocktails have their place and you can easily think about, you know, when you would enjoy a cocktail. Beer has a special place and you'd enjoy, you know, like when you would want to drink a beer at a game, it's a hot day, you're in the backyard, that's its place. But how often are you going to be enjoying a really nice meal and the thing that you want to be drinking along with that meal is beer or a cocktail? It's a unique beverage. It's a celebratory thing. It really actually has been a deep part of human society for thousands of years. And I just don't see that changing anytime soon. I think as people get older, they discover it. They start tasting wine. They start with cheaper wines. And the thing about more expensive wines is you don't have to be a wine snob. They just taste better. And so as you have the opportunity to try better wines, you know, whereas you might be satisfied with a $12 grocery store brand before, you'd be like, you know what, that wine I tried, I really liked it. I want more of that. And I just don't see that going away. So I am not as concerned as some of the people in the industry.
Yeah. And it's always been the common norm, right? You're at a dinner table and whenever you have steak, you have red wine, or when you have fish, you have white wine. Yep. And it was always that customary thing for dinner, you know, at least for me, you know, my family never had beer for dinner or something. No. Like exactly.
Yeah. And the reason for that is less, to my mind, the traditional aspect, and more because that's the beverage that actually goes best with that experience. You know, and so when you do combine that with the tradition, it's just a powerful thing, wine. And there's the romantic side of it. There's the snobbery of sommelier culture. There is all that. But I really think that people enjoying wine and that continuing to be a part of people's lives is, again, it's just the actual product itself. Wine really is delicious and for its own special reason. And not everyone is going to kind of get more interested in it as a hobby or take it more seriously. But the people that do, wine is endlessly fascinating. There's so much to it. And unlike beer, which is much more like bread in that it's a recipe that you follow, if you do it right, you can make it the same way every time, which is why your favorite beer should always taste the same. You know, wine is an ephemeral thing. Every year it's different. No matter what you do, you can't produce it the same way. And so that inherently, it's intrinsically special in that way. And it changes over time and develops. And so even that one wine that was made that one year will be different every time you try it, if you open it at a different time. And yeah, there's really nothing else remotely like that.
You seem to have some personal firsthand experience on these wine brands and how it's such a difficulty or challenge getting into that industry. How do you know?
Well, selling Deerfield for a decade, you know, taught me all about that. And we actually had the benefit of a built-in consumer base that was built over many decades. My uncle had made his first Deerfield label in 1982. And it was kind of a very boutique brand for many years. They operated a bed and breakfast, and basically the wine was sold to the guests and the wine clubs were signed up over dinner at their home. But the wine was absolutely terrific. I mean, really incredibly good wine. And so when they finally had opened the large winery, and it is a very impressive winery in the heart of Sonoma Valley, there's a 23,000 square foot wine cave and the tasting room is smack in the center of it. It's neat. If you're ever in Sonoma Valley, go check out Deerfield. You will not be disappointed. You know, even with that attraction of the tasting room in the middle of the cave and a very unique premise at the time, which was clean wine, that's since been really hotly debated in the wine press and food and wine sections and newspapers and magazines all over the country. And in the past years, Cameron Diaz came out with a brand claiming clean wine, and oh my God, it blew up in her face. And since then, it's been a hot topic. But for a long time before that, Deerfield had a commitment to clean wine, which is, in our conception, yeah, go for it.
I'm not trying to cut you off, yeah. But what is clean wine? I'm not.
It's basically, from our conception, is wine specifically that's low in histamines and low in sulfites. So You probably heard of sulfites. And the issue is not no sulfites. You really do need sulfites in the wine production process in order to make a quality shelf-stable wine. But the issue is that people tend to use way too much. I'm very allergic to sulfites. And a lot of people are. It gives you constricted airways, flushing reaction. It's quite noticeable. It's not one of those things where it's like, oh, am I allergic to it or not? You definitely notice. I've got some slight asthma and it immediately makes me start to wheeze. And I can tell when we're drinking 40 wines if a wine has a lot of sulfites in it, like right away. But histamine is a little bit more tricky one, and it's just about maintaining a clean fermentation environment. And so the red wine headache that people talk about. We believe that that's not about the tannin, as some people think. It's really about histamines that are present in the wine. So my initial point was that clean wine was a huge selling point for Deerfield. It's so hard to stand out in the market. And even with a very unique selling point, which we could back up with people's personal experiences, and we had a huge amount of followers that said, you know, Deerfield's the only wine that I can reliably drink without getting a red wine headache. Even with that, it's just an uphill battle. And now that there's been so much consolidation in the wine industry, the large wine companies have a lot of clout with distributors. And the only way to build a large wine business is ultimately through distribution. And it is extremely hard to break in and get attention by the distributors, because you can imagine if a distributor has, you know, let's say 1,000 different wines in their portfolio, that sales rep is walking into a restaurant or a grocery store and attempting to make a sale, they have to pick a wine. They can't show 1,000 different wines. They can't know 1,000 different wines. So typically what happens is that they push the wines that they're incentivized to do so internally by their company. Maybe the winery has a specific incentive for the sales rep, or they just sell the wines that are the easiest to sell because they have the most name recognition, which is then backed up by the winery's advertising, et cetera, getting, you know, print and all that. So if you're a smaller producer, it's really, really hard to work with a distributor, because the big ones that are effective don't have time to hawk your product. And then the medium and small size distributors, which have smaller portfolios, they just don't have the same kind of means. They don't have the number of sales reps on the ground. They don't have the kind of clout with the grocery stores. It really is kind of set up to be difficult. You have to build a direct-to-consumer brand if you're a small or medium-sized winery.
Now, whenever it comes to wine, I always hear people or wine connoisseurs sort of use this term vintage. Vintage this, vintage that. What does vintage actually mean?
It means the year that the grapes themselves were picked and then processed into wine. So if you're drinking a 2017, then that means that those grapes were picked in 2017. So there is such a thing as a non-vintage wine. And there is regulation at the federal level for what the percentage can be of different vintages, of different varietals. So I believe if it says Cabernet, which is the varietal, on the front of the label, then that wine has to be at least 75% Cabernet. So if it says Cabernet, it could actually be 25% Merlot is in there. Whatever the region that it's from, it has to be 85% from there. So if you say it's Napa Valley, it has to be 85% from Napa Valley. And I think that vintage is the most stringent one. I'm pretty sure it's 90%. So if you say that it's a 2017, it has to be 90% a wine from 2017. It might actually be 95%. It is the most strict one. And so, but you can, if you'd like, you can not put the vintage on there at all, and it's a non-vintage wine, and then you can do whatever the heck you want, blending different years together. However, immediately your wine is almost worthless. And by almost worthless, I mean, you'll still sell it. Carlo Rossi sells a lot of it, but it's going to be worth like $3 a bottle.
Really? I didn't know that. So it's not 100% usually from that time period. You could put maybe a certain amount from that previous time and then kind of, you know, fill it with something else. Do that?
Yeah, you can. I think I'm forgetting if it's 5% or 10%, but you can do that. Mixing different vintages together is very uncommon. The reason that there's even a little bit of an acceptability is because of what's called topping off. So as the wine sits in the barrel or whatever the aging vessel is, it evaporates at actually a pretty surprising rate. And so as the wine goes down, you have to keep that vessel full so as you don't introduce oxygen. But as the wine evaporates in the barrel, you have to add wine back in. And it would just be impractical for wineries to just always be able to make sure that they're using particularly that vintage. And so what they end up using is, we just even call it topping material. Usually it's such a small overall percentage that, you know, it's kind of trivial. You're not going to put white wine in a red wine, but if you're adding a little bit of Merlot to a cab, we don't even tend to record that addition to it because it's such a small amount. That's the primary time that you'll use wines from different vintages. If you have a particularly not necessarily bad vintage, but let's just say the vintage, it was not a very hot year, and so the flavors didn't get extremely ripe. Okay, you might use a different wine from a different vintage that's like just got a little bit more flavor profile to help enhance it. But the typical thing where you'll see blending that's not on the label is in the varietals. So the way to think about it is just like ingredients in cooking, like or soup. You know, every varietal has Cabernet, Merlot, Pinot Noir. They all have their own flavor profiles. They taste different. Even if you don't know anything about wine, I'll give you two different varietals that are really good examples of those varietals, and you'd be like, yeah, they taste different to me. I can't say what it is, but they taste different. So each of them have their own kind of flavor profile. And when you mix them together, just like when you're making a soup, it's going to be greater than the sum of its parts. So, you know, add a little bit of salt because it needs a little bit more to bring the flavor out and lift it up. That's when you'll see blends happen. And unless the producer makes a huge show out of it being 100% Cabernet, for example, almost always there's a small amount of other varietals blended in there, as the case of Petit Verdot, which I mentioned earlier.
Okay. Well, I just learned something new there.
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing is the location. I mean, you know, the value of a wine, people always want to know, like, why is this bottle worth, you know, $80 and this bottle's worth 10? The primary reason is because of the location the grapes come from and then how specific on the label itself it gets. So if it just says California on it, those grapes can be from anywhere in California, and they could be from super different areas like Central Coast and the North Bay. That's immediately an indicator this is a lower quality wine. And you go from state to a county. Okay, if it says Sonoma County or Napa County, or it's still, even though those are premier wine regions, it's still not going to be very valuable. You can get that bottle of wine for $10. Then you get to a specific appellation. And in the United States, we call them AVAs, American Viticultural Area. And this is where it says Sonoma Valley or Rock Pile or Moon Mountain. It's a formal area that's recognized by the government that has a certain type of characteristics to it, like topographical characteristics. And then you can get a vineyard designate where it's like, these grapes are from this exact vineyard, and I can show you on a map exactly where they are. And the more specific it gets like that, then the more you can basically trust the source of it. And that has intrinsic value. And then if it's from a particularly prestigious vineyard where people know that good grapes come from, well, then you're basically saying, like, this is a certificate of authority saying that this wine is made from this place, and you know that these grapes are good. And because that commands a higher price point, the grape grower themselves charges more for those grapes. So a lot of that increased cost is because the grapes themselves cost significantly more. To give you an idea of how much, I mean, in the Central Coast, you can get a ton of grapes for $300. And in Napa Valley, those same, you know, grapes can cost, you know, upwards of $10,000 per ton.
Is that because the grapes are higher quality?
Simply put, yes, they are higher quality. They taste better. If you actually tasted the grapes, even before you made the wine, if you just picked a bunch of grapes, popped in your mouth, you'd be like, those are really, really good grapes from the Napa. I don't know how you did that, but those are some damn tasty grapes. And a lot of it just comes from how the grapes are grown themselves. This weird conflict of interests between grape growers and winemakers, because growers get paid by the ton. So it's by weight. So their incentive is to grow more grapes. But wine tastes much better when there's fewer grapes produced per vine and the flavors are concentrated. So when you picture vineyards in your mind and you see the way all the grapes are grown, that is because of human hands, why the grapes are grown that way. If you let a grapevine grow by itself, it'll just turn into like a giant, crazy, sprawling, viney mess. And it'll produce, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of different bunches per plant. But if you look at a grapevine and walk up to it, you'll see that it's very specific. You know, there's a couple different methods, but the cordon method, there's basically four canes grown per cordon, so eight total, and then two bunches per cane. So 16 bunches of grapes, and all of the rest, it's cut off super labor intensively, I might add. So it's cut off to reduce the yield to exactly that much. So one of the things that you'll see in a very, you know, high-end vineyard is that the bunches are very small, the grapes are very small. You're working really hard to reduce the yield per square acre. Whereas, you know, in a region that's just like make wine grapes, like essentially the entire Central Valley, where many, many, many millions of tons of fruit is produced, the grapevines are just grown for vigor and productivity, basically. But the largest wine company in the entire world is E&J Gallo, which is a California native and still family owned and operated. Very successful. The Gallo family is really impressive. They got their beginnings in Modesto, and to this day, that's where their headquarters are. And, you know, they're the most successful wine company in the entire world. So you can't hate on the Central Coast fruit. They made a fortune.
Okay. And what wine are you most excited to release this year?
Well, that's the crazy thing about Wine Spies is we've got insane wines literally every day of the week. So tomorrow we've got Cheval Blanc, which is literally one of the top 10 most prestigious wines in the world. And that's made in Pomerol in France. But these guys branched out, and Cheval Blanc recently started a new project in Argentina. And interestingly, they're actually calling it Cheval Blanc, which is very unusual. Like, you know, you might've heard of Lafite de Rothschild or Chateau Margaux. These are, you know, the most prestigious wineries in the world that cost $1,000 a bottle. Typically when they want to, you know, buy a new property or start a new project, they're not going to call it Chateau Margaux and kind of dilute that brand. But interestingly, this is actually Cheval Blanc in Argentina, so halfway across the world, and they're taking it extremely seriously. And so for the French to say, you know what, we looked all over the world and we think that this area is that amazing for producing the highest quality wine in the world, it's a pretty big deal. So we're really excited about that. And to give you an idea of kind of discounts that we do, tomorrow's wine, it retails for $125. And we'll be selling it for $80. So it's a pretty significant discount, you know, but we actually play with all different price points. So we had a Reposado from Spain earlier this week. We sold it for $19. We had actually a Pomerol that we had for $25. That we really span the price point. So if you're comfortable, you know, at a $20 wine or comfortable at a $100 wine, Wine Spies has you covered. The one thing that's always the same is it's always going to be a crazy deal.
And do you have any special advice for people that might want to follow in your footsteps and start a winery as well?
Well, my standard advice is do not do something else. And if you're into wine and you want to pursue a wine career, there's plenty of awesome places to work. I would very much recommend that, you know, you spend at least a decade in the wine industry before trying to start your own wine brand. If it's the kind of thing where ultimately like that really is your passion, you want to pursue it, I recommend getting a lot of knowledge and really understanding the fundamentals of how the wine industry works before you go there. For those people that say there's a barrier to entry for the wine industry, I say that's absolute nonsense. During harvest, there is always a massive shortage of harvest workers. And that is where you really learn to make wine. Because the coolest thing about starting as a harvest intern is the winemaker is really the decision maker. They come around and they tell you what to do. They give you a work order and they say, you know, go and do like punch down this tank or sort this fruit and put it in this tank. But as a winery intern with zero experience, you really do get to participate in the entire process of actually making wine from start to finish. So you get a really, really good experience of what it actually looks like to make the wine. And when you start at the bottom of a totem pole like that, it's a very natural progression. You start working harvest. If you work your butt off, you know, maybe you can stick around for the rest of the season. If you don't get to stick around for the rest of the season, you go to the other hemisphere. So there's a lot of people when they're starting their career, you know, they basically do Northern Hemisphere harvest, and then they immediately go to like Australia, for example, and do the harvest down there and then go back and forth. And if you keep doing that and apply to new places, eventually you'll find a winery that will keep you on past the growing season, work your way up to lab tech, work your way up to assistant winemaker. And then on the business side, similarly, there's always a huge shortage of tasting room staff. It's easy to get stuck in a tasting room position, but I will say, you know, just like any other business, if you work your butt off and you really shine, you'll be noticed and there's always a need for talent. So I think that there's excellent entry-level positions and it's one of the few businesses where you do not need a degree. If you love wine, it's definitely an awesome career to pursue.
And where could people reach out to you?
Well, me personally, you can reach out to me at agentcrew@winespies.com, spelled C-R-U. But yeah, check out our site. I mean, Wine Spies is a really fun. Yeah, there it is. So that's today's wine, the Essere Franco, and actually getting almost close to sold out here. So far today, we've almost sold a pallet of wine. We got like, there's 672 bottles in a pallet. And yeah, it's really fun. Like I said, always a crazy deal. So $120 typically, and today less than $50 from Wine Spies. This, as you can see, is Coombsville Cab Sauv. If you click on what the winery says, you can see that we offer a lot of detail, you know, the winemaker, the specific blend. We'd talked about different varietals getting blended together. So this is actually 100% Cabernet Sauvignon. And this is actually from a specific appellation. This is from Coombsville. And even further, this is from a specific vineyard. And even further, the clones of Cabernet is laid out. So a ton of information to be found. Oh yeah. And we also made a pretty badass commercial. Check that out sometime.
Nice. Yeah. All right. So this has been an excellent interview. Do you have any other words, suggestions, final things you'd like to say?
The piece of advice I always give is, you know, if you're interested in wine and want to learn more about it, the best thing to do is taste a lot of different wine. And the only thing that you have to do is just remember where that wine that you had came from. And it's as simple as when you're drinking the wine, look at the label. Take the mental time to go, I am drinking this such and such producer and it is this varietal and it is from, you know, this area. And that's it. And I think people drink wine for years and years and years and kind of never refine their palate or even figure out what specifically it is they like just because they're skipping that one step. So, you know, you don't need to get a wine book. You don't need to go get a bunch of wine gadgets. You know, you don't even need to go buy a bunch more wine. Just next time you are drinking wine, wherever you're at, just take that time to look at the label and connect what you're tasting with what it says on the front of that label and make that mental association.
All right. Thank you again. All right.
I appreciate you. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Excellent. So just to end this off quickly here, last few things we'd like to shout out for. The first thing is LifeWork Systems. This is our affiliate and collaborative partner. She's essentially an HR superstar, and she goes into large businesses and basically improves the workforce and helps you build a better collegial environment. If you need to work with her, please contact me and I can give you the connections that you need. Next thing is our YouTube channel. Subscribe now. We're slowly growing in subscribers. So if you want to know about our next interviews, next shows coming up, just subscribe now. And then the next thing here, our Roku channel. This will be on Roku TV as well as everything else. So that's basically the majority of everything. And the last thing we have to shout out here is Jimbo Paris Services. We have a drop servicing business and a marketing agency. We help build content, automate your website, and in general, just help you with marketing. So I'm Jimbo Paris. This is the Jimbo Paris Show. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening to the Jimbo Paris Show.